Thank you very much. It's always a joy to come to Cambridge. In the 20 years I've gotten to live here, I've lived in Yorkshire and the London area, and now I get to live in Oxford. I know that's not probably as favorable as Cambridge for many of you, but I just love living here. And while I've been here, I've gotten the chance to study this topic in a great deal of depth and enjoy the wonderful manuscript riches that there are in Britain's libraries. This talk will be a little bit technical. And I think because the seriousness of the subject demands accuracy and precision. These are very sensitive issues when we talk about the histories of our scriptural texts, when we talk about divine revelation and inspiration of scripture. It isn't just an academic issue. And so tonight, I'm going to speak very carefully, but I hope very clearly, accurately, and fairly as well. Historically, textual criticism of manuscripts has come to be foundational to literary criticism in the West. It's a practice where the manuscripts of a particular document, if they're in multiple manuscripts and you don't have the original text, that by comparing the texts of these extant copies very carefully, very precisely, and using some very time-honored principles, you can discern what is most likely the original text of that document if you have a sufficient number of manuscripts to work from. This has come to be a scholarly discipline that's taken for granted in many areas. The Greek and Latin classics, medieval European literature, and especially the New Testament and the Hebrew Bible. Studies of these literatures have based themselves. They've said the very first step of what you need to do before any serious study of these texts is to establish the best form of the original text that you can achieve through the study of their manuscripts. And this is especially true for the Bible, and the New Testament is perhaps the single most studied literary tradition this way of any in the world. Hans Küng said this back in the early 1990s, and it's still true. He said, "Lay people are usually unaware that the scrupulous scholarly work achieved by modern biblical criticism, represented by scrupulous academic work over about 300 years, belongs among the greatest intellectual achievements of the human race. Has any of the great world religions outside of the Jewish Christian tradition investigated its own foundations and its own history so thoroughly and so impartially? None of them has remotely approached this. The Bible is far and away the most studied book in world literature." And I think by most studied, he's especially meaning examined critically. Just to give you the fruit of 300 years of research, many of you will be aware of what's called a critical Greek New Testament. There are a number of different ones available. This is probably the most popular. And what you have is the Greek text that's found in manuscripts, but wherever there's a textual variant, especially a significant one for meaning or from a particularly important manuscript, that textual variant will be noted down here in the apparatus, is what it's called. And it's a very meticulous, very precise system for notating exactly which textual variant goes where that you get keys into an index in the back, where that manuscript is located. So that just from this, you can find out where any significant textual variant exists in a Greek manuscript in the world. It's an enormous undertaking that has involved the collation of thousands of manuscripts. It's a wonderful achievement that we have to work from. And this is now the basis, and has been for quite a while, for all the major translations of the Bible in the world. However, this has never been done for the Quran. And it's widely acknowledged in the scholarly community that there's never been a critical text for the Quran, as has been done with other sacred books and other bodies of literature. And the current printed texts of the Quran are not based on the collation of ancient manuscripts. They're instead based on a traditional view of the text that comes out of medieval Islamic Quran literature. And there have been historically many limitations preventing the production of a critical text. The greater need at this moment is actually the preliminary work of developing tools and methods for the eventual goal of producing a critical text. Things like facsimiles of manuscripts, collations of manuscripts. Compared to the New Testament, these kind of studies are at least 100 years behind for the study of the Quran. So the study behind tonight's presentation is contained in my books, and I view it as just contributions to this preliminary work. There's an enormous amount to do, and mine are initial forays into this enormous field. Okay. I think that comparison to the New Testament tradition, that is, comparison of the Quran's manuscript tradition to the New Testament, is particularly useful. First of all, because the New Testament is also a book held by billions to be sacred scripture. It also has an extensive manuscript tradition, both in the number of manuscripts and also in the ages of those manuscripts and the stages of development of the New Testament text that they present. The Quran also has a very extensive manuscript tradition, going back to very early in regard to the beginnings of Islam. So there, it's a useful comparison that way. However, though, the New Testament manuscript tradition has been thoroughly studied, particularly in the last three centuries, and a consensus has grown in academia and also in almost all Christian denominations that the texts used for worship and devotion ought to be based on the rigorous study of these manuscripts instead of relying solely or mainly on a traditional form of the text, like, say, the Latin Vulgate or the authorized version in the Greek text underneath the authorized version of the English Bible. A view that marks Russian scholarship on the Quran I found particularly useful. They seek to combine both a critical attitude as far as taking it, a hard look at what the manuscripts present, and using a critical mindset, asking difficult questions, really trying to analyze the issues, but also trying to maintain an attitude of sympathy and respect. And I think this is particularly important for Christians involved in these studies. I think we have an opportunity that we know what it is like to hold a book in such high regard that we consider it in some sense divine, like Muslims hold the Quran. And that provides a tremendous basis of sympathy that we can have, that we can share. I think true objectivity can only be reached if there's a willingness for self-criticism and an openness to correction. And I think the sympathetic respect part, by maintaining that, we can graciously acknowledge areas of similarity, but also difference, and allow them to stand for careful mutual scrutiny. I hope tonight's talk is received in a way that acknowledges these motives that I've tried to maintain throughout my research and also my working life. Now, just to mention a bit about the basic research project that my studies started out of and have developed since then. What I tried to do was just take a small portion of text in the New Testament and a similar sized portion in the Quran, take those portions and read them across at least 20 representative manuscripts from each tradition, carefully analyze them for any textual variations, and then, that's what the collating the text is, and then analyze those variants for their significance. Now, I used a method that in New Testament studies is called reasoned eclecticism, and it's an approach to manuscripts that seeks to balance giving priority to the oldest and best manuscripts available, to also the reading in each individual text that best explains why that textual variant has come into existence. So I tried to use that same method in both traditions. Just some pictures of some of the manuscripts I was privileged to use. Codex Sinaiticus in the British Library. This is the oldest complete Greek New Testament in existence. Dates back to about 350 AD. Codex Lestrensis, which dates to the 1300s. This is in a completely different script style and is representative of a part of the Greek manuscript tradition that's in this script style. Another one I got to use was an Arabic translation of the Book of Acts that's found in a manuscript in St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai. And this particular manuscript is dated to about 862. It was written by a Nestorian monk, translated by a Nestorian monk who was living under Islamic rule. Some of the Quran manuscripts, one was this one on display in the British Library. If you go into the public display room in the British Library, and in one cabinet you'll see Codex Sinaiticus, if you just walk across the aisle and around the corner a little bit, you'll see this one. And this is one of the most important, one of the oldest Quran manuscripts in the world. And I got to use that one. I got to use pictures of some of the Sana manuscripts. You may have heard that back in the 1970s, some ancient Quran manuscripts were found between the inner and the outer domes of the Grand Mosque in Sana, Yemen. In a way, it's kind of like a Dead Sea Scrolls find for the Quran. About 16,000 pages of manuscript material, a few hundred Quran fragments, some complete Qurans were in those finds. And in those are the very oldest Qurans that have been found yet in the world. And I got to use pictures of some of those. Also, this is a manuscript available in facsimile form. It's on display in a museum in Istanbul, the Topkapi Museum. And Muslims around the world hold this to be one of the most important early Quran manuscripts in existence. So I got to use some tremendous manuscript resources, the very best of both traditions. The aims of textual criticism of all this study is when you find these little textual variations and you analyze them, you try and determine what effect do they have for helping us establish what was the original form of text, or the oldest available form of text if you can't quite get back so far. And then also using them to trace the historical development of that text. When you have manuscripts over centuries, you can sometimes track small but significant changes to the text. So I use both of these goals. And I also framed some research questions. These are just three of them. What kinds of variants do both traditions have in common, and what kinds are unique to them, respectively? What's the earliest attainable text for each book of Scripture? I used Acts, and I used one chapter in the Quran. That can be discerned through textual criticism of manuscripts. Is there one precise version of the Quran going back to Muhammad? This is a particular issue in the claims made for the textual history of the Quran, and I wanted to see, can the manuscripts provide any kind of information toward answering this? All right. Overall, I was thoroughly impressed in both traditions by this conclusion that Bruce Metzger had after years of looking at New Testament manuscripts. That after you see the copyist mistakes, after you even see intentional changes to the text, you still see also a lot of evidence of careful, painstaking work on the part of many faithful copyists. Even in incidental details, one observes the faithfulness of scribes. And you can sense the devotion that they brought to the text. You can sense the sense of worship at times that they brought. I found a spectrum of categories. I can only highlight the most important ones tonight. But let me just say, for the New Testament side of things, I found what you could call a full spectrum of textual variants, anything from copyist mistakes to attempts to improve the writing of the Greek, to correct spelling, to change the sound of particular words, to improve grammar or style, and very occasionally, perhaps, to strengthen a doctrine or to make a teaching that seems a bit vague in this particular context a little bit clearer, to help the reader understand what the scribe thinks is meant at this particular point in the text. And the textual variants were from individual letters to phrases and even portions in length. That's what we have to work with. And this spectrum is also a very similar spectrum to what you find in the Greek and Latin classics. It's similar to what you'll find in the Hebrew Bible manuscript tradition as well. These kind of changes. For instance, now this is from the Old Testament portion of Codex Sinaiticus, but I love this picture because it's the single most corrected page in this entire manuscript. And you can see just about every way scribes would correct a text. You see the little additions written, you know, in whatever leftover space there is. You see these dots over letters, which were a convention to mark redundant letters or incorrect letters. You'll find marginal notations that sometimes they're like commentary, but sometimes they're commenting on the actual text. Another place here. One in particular I want to point out is right here. Now this is the name of Ezra. Ezra Khan. And here it involved a scribe erasing the name and correcting the spelling. But even when he corrected it, he got it a little bit wrong and he forgot the Z. So he added the Z in. Right there. He forgot that little Z, and so he put it up just above. The thing I want you to take away from just this image is that almost all the time, New Testament scribes were careful to leave the text as they found it intact and to make their corrections in a way that the prior text could still be read. Okay? It's very important. Usually about the only time you have a whole-scale erasure and rewrite of text is when the original scribe himself is correcting his own work. not a later scribe coming back and erasing a whole portion and rewriting it. Okay. When I came to the Quran manuscripts, I found a more restricted spectrum. Fewer in kind, fewer in number. Though, there were both unintentional and intentional textual variants. And usually no more than a letter or at very most a word. It's very startling, the difference. Yeah. Just to show some of them to you. The ones I found, some of the ones I found, these are also representative of others that others have found in other manuscripts as well. So these are representative. First of all, in Arabic, to distinguish between certain consonants, they'll use dots added to this consonantal line of text, similar to Hebrew in that respect. And here, these two dots make this letter a Y. These two dots make this letter a T. And the difference the placement of those dots makes is it changes the person. When you reckon the account, speaking about God, or when the account is reckoned. God's there, but he's not being directly spoken about. So a small difference in meaning, but nonetheless a real difference of meaning. It would also have a difference of sound if two different people were reciting the text. It would have a very different sound. Here, it's this letter. This stroke is like a one dot, and it would make it an N. And here you have the two again to make that a Y. And here the difference is what he conceals rather than what we conceal. And what he conceals is speaking of humanity. What we conceal is, in the Quran, there's use of a plural of majesty. And so that's Allah speaking. So who's the subject of that? That's the difference just those two dots make. You'll also find occasionally substitution of conjunctions. This happens in Greek texts a fair amount. Here's fa, which means so, and wa, which is an and. And this one was actually corrected to read wa. It's not a big difference, but it is a difference. What I found when I analyzed these closely was that you had the same kind of things as that many of them were to improve or standardize or update the orthography from an old style of Arabic to a newer style. You definitely had ones to correct copyist mistakes. But there was an additional kind of correction. And this was to standardize the reading of the text toward what we would know now as the standard form of text. The Quran has a very, very precise form of text. And it took about 4 centuries for Muslims to come to that form. And you can see in these early manuscripts attempts to shape the text to make it read that very specific, particular way. You'll also find occasionally omitted words, and this could be intentional or unintentional. Just a small two-letter word here is not found in that text. In the manuscripts I had that represented the bulk of the Quranic manuscript tradition, that was the largest single variant I found of this type. I didn't find phrases that were different or words that were different. Part of the situation is that textual variants in Greek that involve letters and even words can be represented in the Arabic by just the placement of those dots. So if you place the dots in a different place, it can be a very significant different construction. Just some general conclusions about these, especially the intentional variants, where a scribe very clearly decided what he was writing. The placement of those dots was a conscious decision on the part of the scribe. While the New Testament intentional variants are the products of individual scribes attempting to make the text more consistent grammatically or stylistically, they were not made according to a preconceived idea of an ideal form of the text. They were instead looking to improve the clarity of the meaning of the text that they had before them as they understood it. They were also doing this with an understanding that they were not to change the meaning away from its basic storyline. And at most, they might have a manuscript that they were copying from that they felt had a better quality text, if they had two, they thought one was better than the other. They might make their reading conform to one of those two. However, the scribes who penned the Quranic intentional variants, while exhibiting this same attitude of staying true to the basic storyline, while making the text more internally consistent, had the added overriding conviction that the text ought to conform to a precise, to a very precise consonantal form, that the text ought to be read in a very specific way. There's also a discernible attitude with the placement of those dots for a couple centuries that the scribes had a permitted degree of freedom in how they pointed their own text within certain parameters. While the consonantal line in the text remained unchanged. This period of freedom, however, ended with the appearance of fully vocalized texts in the 10th century, 900s. It was by then that they had come to a way of notating every little phonetic possibility of the text, and that's what you'll have in an Arabic Quran now. That system was developed around the 900s to 1000 AD. For the New Testament, most intentional variants and corrections were made to correct grammar and orthography and to improve the style. Most were not done for dogmatic reasons to strengthen some particular doctrine under attack. For the Quran, many intentional variants and corrections were made to improve the orthography as well, but many were also done for a potentially dogmatic reason, to conform the text to one precise text form. And you'll see a bit more of that in these next slides. Physical corrections, manual corrections in manuscripts. I came across one in one of the manuscripts that is rather startling. And if you look, there are three major places. There are 12 little places all together on this page, but the three major ones. This is going out. Anyway, if you look up on line 4 and line 5, this, and then here, and here. And what you have there, on the bigger one, you have a few words that have been rubbed out. And they've been rubbed out so well that they cannot, you cannot read what they originally were. The text was actually scraped to get all that ink off. And then what was written over that scraping is what is now considered to be standard text. And if you do a very close examination of the spacing of the letters, you find that what was there originally must have been shorter because the standard text is too long to fit the space. And it's been written in a slightly different script style. Down here on these two, the words to be replaced were actually longer than the standard text, so they had to stretch the words out. See that? in that one. When you start looking in other manuscripts, it turns out this is a fairly common practice. This is one of the manuscripts found in Sana'a, Yemen, and two lines were rubbed out and rewritten with what is now standard text. And you can tell at just how small the letters had to be to fit in all that new text. Here's one I found recently at the Bodleian, where these words were rubbed out. And this was a particularly interesting one in that I found in some early Quran literature that some Muslims read those particular words in a different way, different words. And it looks like someone put a medieval equivalent of Tippex over it and then scraped that off to get back to the original. Now that's corrections, but also on an even larger scale, in those Sana'a finds was found the very oldest Quran manuscript in the world. And this is a part of an image of one of its pages. This dates into the 600s, and a palimpsest is a manuscript that its original text was washed off and then it was written over. And in New Testament studies, there are at least 55, 56 of them that are used for constructing that critical text. I know of only two different Quranic palimpsests in existence. There may be more. Three. And one of them is here in the library at Cambridge. This one's still in Yemen, but it's being prepared for publication in France right now. And it should be coming out in a facsimile form in the next year. You can see the underlying text that was originally washed off has come back in that light brown ghost writing. And with the help of ultraviolet light, infrared light, and just looking really hard, you can recover just about all of what was originally written on that page. There are about 80 pages of this kind of material in this manuscript. And it's currently being studied. About 10 pages of it have been thoroughly studied so far for textual variations in that underlying text. And what they're finding is that that underlying text has the most textual variants of any Quran manuscript in existence. And what it basically shows is a different form of the text from what we know in the Quran now. That's the same kind of teaching, but you'll find different words. You'll find added and omitted phrases, even a missing verse. Basically, the kinds of textual variants that we're used to in New Testament studies, this underlying text in this particular palimpsest has those same kind of issues. And it's unique in the world for that. Just some of the different textual variants found so far. Now, I want to just take you through some reasons why this palimpsest is so significant, and also keep in mind the corrections as well, because they're in the same kind of category. Though they affect meaning and involve portions of the text, they stay within the realm of current ideas and emphases in the Quran so far. Nobody's expecting to discover, you know, a completely unknown surah, chapter of the Quran or anything like that. But it has a greater number and variety of variants than any other Quran manuscript. These greater numbers and variety are in line as far as they are of the same quality, the same kind as what you find in the transmissions of other ancient literatures. The layers of text demonstrate development from one form of text to the standard. This The upper text is very close to what is now considered to be standard text. Still some differences, but it's very, very close, recognizably so. So it shows development. It's thought that the layers are possibly within a generation of each other, 30 years, 20, 40 years in that kind of a window. The layers of, okay, this provides some of the first substantial evidence of editing in the latter half of Islam's first century on the text of the Quran. Now this is outside of the life of Muhammad. And so this palimpsest is a very controversial manuscript. It also provides evidence of an earlier era in the Quran's textual history where there was a flexibility of reading that was later restricted. Also, larger variant portions reported in early Islamic literature have not been found in these manuscripts. This has been a kind of a conundrum. If you go in the Church Fathers and look at their quotations of the New Testament, you can very often tie it directly to a form with a manuscript. And in the literature like that for the Quran, there are sometimes reports of large portions of the Quran that are missing, like 200 verses from one surah. Well, those portions have not been found yet in a manuscript. They haven't been found yet in this palimpsest. And this is the first physical manuscript evidence of other text types of the Quran. Though they're reported in the Quranic literature, this is the actual first physical evidence of these other forms of the text. The results I came to, just concerning the New Testament, that a reliable version of the original text can be discerned from within the texts of existing manuscripts, and as presented in the work of New Testament critical texts. My work confirmed the kind of work that's already been going on. For the Quran, an early edited version has been preserved through manuscripts and oral tradition, but no critical text from manuscripts has been constructed. There are similarities between the two traditions. Both have unintentional errors, both have intentional changes, grammatical changes, improving the orthography, corrections of mistakes. For the New Testament, you find a greater variety, a number of textual variants, and they point to an informal standardization process of the text over centuries. For the Quran, you have a smaller variety and number of variants, which point to a more formal standardization process, establishing a precise form of the text for liturgical, dogmatic, possibly political reasons. What are the earliest identifiable tests for the New Testament and the Quran? Well, one scholar today on the New Testament has been saying and implying in a lot of his work that there was a lot more intentional changes to the New Testament text than we would realize. And he's been very busy to promote a view that you really can't trust the text of the New Testament. His name's Bart Ehrman. And this is kind of the heart of his thinking of why he thinks that's so. And I just want you to think through this as I read it. He's talking about the scribes that were transcribing these manuscripts. They were textual interpreters. At the same time, by physically altering the words, when they did an intentional change, they did something quite different from other exegetes, and this difference is by no means to be minimized. Whereas all readers change a text when they construe it in their minds, the scribes actually changed the text on the page. As a result, they created a new text, a new concatenation of words over which future interpreters would dispute, no longer having access to the words of the original text, the words produced by the author. Now that can sound pretty dire as far as the reliability of the New Testament. But what he's portraying there is a very linear transmission process. And what he's not taking into account is that we have a very broad spectrum of manuscripts and a large number of manuscripts representing a number of these lines of transmission. And so with work like this, you can discern, scholars can discern where an intentional change has been made and corrected. And this has been going on for 200 years. It actually is more pertinent to the Quran. If you think about this early period in the 7th century, the 600s, that this palimpsest represents, if that text was fixed in that century, as Islamic historical sources assert, they say that the third caliph, Uthman, called in variant copies of the text of the Quran, formed a committee to establish one text, and when they had done that, copy that in multiple copies, and then he ordered the variant copies that they'd worked from burned, destroyed. And this is a story I found that Muslims almost universally know this story. And this has supposedly happened within 25 years of Muhammad's death. If that happened, you have this situation. That action by Uthman cut off access to any more original forms of the Quranic text. And that palimpsest may be one of the few testimonies to that actual process of forced standardization of a text. So, we have a wealth of riches with manuscripts available to us for the New Testament. For the Quran, this is a comment that B.F. Westcott, scholar who was here in Cambridge, just made. He was a New Testament scholar, and he made an offhanded comment on what he knew of the historical count of the Quran being standardized. He just said, when the Caliph Uthman fixed a text of the Quran and destroyed all the old copies which differed from his standard, he provided for the uniformity of subsequent manuscripts at the cost of their historical foundation. A classical text which rests finally on a single archetype is that which is open to the most serious suspicions. And I can say that my examination of these other Quran manuscripts actually confirms this. The text is too clean. It's too uniform when you compare it with other ancient traditions. It's not a normal textual transmission. At best, there can be recovered a heavily edited version of the continental text of perhaps some of Muhammad's autographic material, some of his original material. The New Testament, having a wider range of variants, shows a lack of active standardization of the text, a lack of organized suppression of variant texts. For the Quran, one form of the text has been kept extremely well. But the process for keeping this form of text required the suppression of variant texts, initial and repeated editing and improvement of the remaining text over 300 years to make the orthography of the Quran a complete phonetic system. And this feature is unique, to my understanding, among ancient literatures. This level of standardization that you can actually observe in manuscripts that ties in with a historical account. I think a fitting illustration comes from forestry. It used to be a common practice when you managed a forest, there were certain trees you could cut off at ground level and they'd send up shoots. And you could harvest those shoots at different times in their growth, use them for different things like tool handles or firewood or building materials. And we've got lots of this coppiced wood just running riot in our woods and hedgerows. Here is what I think Uthman did. That out of what you could say is the root ball of Muhammad's teachings, when it started sending up these shoots of different forms of the text that Islamic tradition tells us about, Uthman called them in and cut them off and tried to establish one. Islamic tradition tells us that that one of them, though, still had a good run. Belonged to a companion of Muhammad's called Ibn Mas'ud. And it wasn't finally chopped down until the 900s. Whereas with the New Testament, the picture's more like this, that you had the teachings of Jesus in an enormous root ball that ended up coming up in a very solid, confined stream of teaching with apostolic authority. And that text didn't come up in all these other shoots. Yes, there was shaping, there was pruning, on a minor scale compared to the Qurans. Just some general comments. This is concerning inspiration. For the New Testament, throughout the history of the church, a verbal plenary model of inspiration has been consistently used to tie together these two features of divine guidance of the writers as to initiating the process, as to guarding what they wrote, guiding them what they wrote. But also it allows for full human involvement, that they wrote according to their experience, their vocabularies, their own knowledge. They weren't mindless automatons. And this view, because it accommodates a full human involvement in the process of scripture being produced, it can accommodate the realities of human involvement in editing of the text. Christians have never claimed a perfectly transmitted text. Since the early church fathers, it was recognized that there were textual variants and mistakes in manuscripts. But what has been claimed consistently is that we have a reliable and sufficient form of the text for belief, for worship, for practice. The Quranic view, though, Muslims have consistently chosen what I would call a divine dictation model. They claim that the text of the Quran was originally on a tablet next to Allah's throne in heaven, and that on a particular night during Ramadan, way, way back in the late 500s, no, I'm sorry, about 610, Allah took a portion of that text that was the Quran and gave it over to the angel Gabriel, who then over the next 23 years delivered it to Muhammad as occasion arose when he needed it. And Muhammad's only part in it was to memorize and repeat. He did not create. There's no human involvement. There's been a consistent attitude that the more something's to be divine, the less human it has to be in Islamic views of inspiration. A lot of this comes from a verse in the Quran, Surah 85. This is a glorious Quran inscribed in a tablet preserved. And this is that tablet next to the throne of Allah. One medieval Islamic commentator has expressed the kind of the majority view through the ages, and that he said the Quran is recited by the tongues, written in the copies, remembered in the hearts, but despite this, it is from eternity subsisting in God's essence, and it does not suffer division and separation by being transferred to the hearts and pages. Basically, that the text of the Quran is a mysterious entity that somehow is in a book, can be spoken, and yet at the same time, it is eternal and uncreated. Muslim theologians have never been able to square that circle, so to speak. They haven't been able to reconcile those two, and so they've just put them together and let them stand as an article of faith. And you will come today, this is a very common, every English book on the Quran I've read, written by Muslims, will have a statement like this. Quran is the word of Allah, retains its pristine purity without the least change, alteration, distortion, division, amendment, or annulment. There's no religious literature other than the last divine scripture, which has escaped contamination, addition, deletion, deformation, etc. The Holy Quran differs from any other religious text in that it was not written or edited by any human author. No word has been added to it or subtracted from it. This is from the Islamic Foundation in Leicester, which publishes a lot of material that's used around the UK. Those statements are made in spite of a fact that there never has been one precise, universally accepted version of the Quran. There's been a form of continental text that's achieved an almost near universal acceptance, but even that hasn't quite done it. And there's this idea, it's that how can you reconcile this, that a strictly divine dictation, well, really, it ought not to be edited by humans if it's to retain its purity and full divine nature. And that's the claims that are being made for the Quran. And yet, in the manuscripts, you can see very human hands editing the text. Concerning the New Testament, Christians of all branches have accepted that the text of the New Testament must be based on careful examination of the earliest and best manuscripts rather than simply relying on a traditional view of the history of the text. And this is a huge upheaval for us, but it's kind of, it's settled down. The biggest blow of it here in Britain and in the West was about a little over 100 years ago. And this 300 plus years of careful academic study have actually demonstrated the integrity of the text that we now that we possess in our hands. Concerning the Quran, there's tremendous evidence of variations in the text. Yet there's a hesitance among Muslims to draw full conclusions from that. While early standardization is recognized, its negative effect on recovering prior forms of the text is not fully recognized. And there's a hesitance to acknowledge any degree of human editing employed to construct the full text of the Quran. So, are these basically just ancient texts that they're all the same? They have the same issues. There's no differences, significant differences. Well, actually, there's a very significant difference between the textual histories of the New Testament and the Quran. They are similar in that there are textual variants of the same kinds in both traditions, but the significant difference in textual history terms is that the New Testament preserves a reliable version of the original text, while the Quran preserves an early edited form of its text made at the expense of more original forms. Beyond this, even if you want to say that this early editing form is authentic and representative and fine to use, the most significant difference between these books on these issues is the difference between their messages, even more than their textual histories. They do not agree with each other. They make mutually exclusive claims to truth. Let me just go back and just mention for myself, I've wrestled with these issues because I've wanted to make sure that my personal faith is based on as solid a foundation as possible, as far as that I have the most historical view of Jesus or any religious figure to make my decisions, to make an informed decision. And I can say from my personal study through these studies that the words of Jesus have been preserved reliably in the New Testament. His teaching is there. We have the true person of Jesus presented to us through this book. And the New Testament provides a historical support for my individual choice of faith in accepting his universal claims to be the only Savior and Lord of mankind. Now, the Quran presents Jesus as being just a human prophet, that he was not divine, that he did not die on the cross, that he never claimed to be part of the Trinity. And these issues of textual history are of foundational importance of deciding which of these accounts has more historical credibility. Evidence can't prove these things to someone bent on being skeptical or just choosing not to believe, but they do provide sufficient evidence for an individual's faith to be based on a legitimate interpretation of the available historical sources concerning Jesus. Instead of the model used by the Greek and Latin classics, the Bible, and other ancient Western literature, Quranic textual criticism as practiced within Islam has worked more towards standardizing the text toward a form that was an ideal form that came about in their own theological debates, rather than seeking to preserve what was originally given in its pristine purity. I think a choice of faith that the Quran is a perfectly preserved book from a heavenly tablet must be done in the face of strong evidence, both from within Islamic tradition and from the surviving manuscript tradition, that there has been intentional editing and shaping of the text at many points in its history. I hope I can suggest without impertinence that Muslims and Christians not allow polemical convenience to dictate our estimates of historical probability on these issues, rather to recognize, as Islamic scholarship and Christian scholarship traditionally have, that we in the world are bound to work with probabilities, even when it comes to the relation of the available Quran and Bible to God's transcendent knowledge. Thank you.